Overthinking It Podcast, episode 21. Hey, what's up?
Oh, man.
I am so amped right now.
It's time to overthink things.
So does it. Nay.
Yeah.
Extreme.
And nothing is up with me that could possibly live up to that introduction.
That's great. Well, hey, I'm glad to have you. So, Jordan Stokes up in this podcast for the first time in a little while.
Yeah. It's nice to be back.
What's going on? What's been going on with you?
I've been traveling the world, you know, going to and forth on the face of the earth and seeing what lies upon it.
Like Kane in Kung Fu.
Yeah, man.
That's exciting.
I thought you were just making one big risotto.
And the mother of all risottos. That is Peter Fenzel. What's going on, Pete?
Not too much. It's freaking freezing in Boston, Massachusetts.
Is it really?
It is so cold that the people in heavy coats are still cold.
And yeah, especially their like hands or ankles or something like that.
Especially if they don't have gloves or shoes.
I saw a woman walking in the cold the other day who was obviously wearing a dress underneath her coat, but her legs were bare, and I thought, oh my god, that's crazy. I've never heard of anything so crazy as that. And, you
pretty
know,
crazy.
I hadn't. Yeah, right? Well, god, I killed that joke. Moving right along. Josh McNeil, it wasn't too cold in Washington, I don't know. I was actually down visiting Josh this weekend. How was it to have me in your house, Josh?
Well, we've almost got it aired out.
That's nice. Yeah, I'm sorry about the incident, but, you know, there's nothing I can do.
And that's why they make bleach.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Hopefully no one comes with, like, a black light or anything to check out the place. And Mark Lee is with us from New York, New York.
Yeah, I just want to make the podcast theme song observation of the week, which is that there's a video segment on Politico.com, which is the exact same music.
Oh, yeah?
I felt strangely at home when I was watching that video.
Well, it is a standard, you know, royalty-free Apple loop that you get with GarageBand 06 or something like that. So, you know, I don't know.
And I was thinking that Politico should be able to commission or buy the rights to a real theme song, seeing as they're kind of a internet media powerhouse, but maybe that's not the case.
Well, I would like a real theme song, so if anyone wants to write one, you can, you know, contact us, and, you know, you always can contact us at podcast@overthinkingit.com or the voicemail, which is 20 eat log 01. That's 203-285-6401.
But do you think the eat log thing is helpful? Is that helpful, the eat log thing?
It's a helpful mnemonic to me because I have difficulty. I always have to look up the number when I go do it, so it's easier to say 20 eat log 01.
Okay.
And as we pointed out before, the first call into that number resulted from us coming up with that mnemonic. So clearly, correlation equals causation. So we're sticking with it. 20 eat log.
My concerns are assuaged.
Okay, our big thing today: Twilight. Well, not really. Not really Twilight. We're not here to talk about Twilight, though. It is kind of. I guess
god
it is.
Damn it.
It is the news hook, right? It is the proximate cause of what we are going to talk about, which is the, you know, just to get into the idea of vampires a little bit. They're sort of a durable kind of thing. And
you have to stick them through the heart or chop their head off.
Right, exactly. I meant as a, you know, narratives of vampires are a durable cultural phenomenon. But so Twilight opened this weekend, the weekend at the end of which we're recording this podcast. The estimated box office is $70.6 million, which is about the same kind of numbers that James Bond did.
Slightly more, right?
I thought Bond was in the ballpark. I forget. I was actually on Variety trying to look up Bond, and their website is extremely hard to use, and I could not I couldn't figure it. Bond, actually still playing, dropped about 60%. It took in 27.4 this weekend. Anyway, so the audience for Twilight was 75% women, which is to be expected, or 75% female, I should say, girls and women. But the surprise is that 45% of the audience, of the total, was over age 25. So it, right, it sort of crossed over into being an adult movie also.
Just to clarify, rather, you probably know best than others, that the novels are decidedly marketed towards young adults, or the youth, the teenagers, as it were.
The youths. Well, the kind of the tweens. They're young adult books. Am I the only guy on the show who has read the books?
I've read 0.5 of the first one, and I'll finish it one of these days when I get the chance.
Yeah.
So when you go to the bookstore, do you find it, in the, where you find the rest of the young adult books?
Well, these days you find it in its own special display at the front of the store, because they're making money hand over fist.
When did the first one come out?
4 years ago.
So the people who were young adults at that point are now older, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the people who were, starting high school when the first one came out are now going off to college.
Right.
I suppose. But, these categories, what do we mean when we say something that, is a young adult book? I mean, sometimes we talk about maybe what we mean is that it's bad. Right?
Well, I don't know about that. Is it really bad?
No, it's pretty bad, but it's not. I mean, that is to say, it has virtues, but they're not the sort of virtues that would be recognized as virtues in, say, a college English department.
Generally, when things are filed under young adult in a bookstore, as a former employee, it just means that they're easy enough to read that you can, give them to a teenager and they won't stop halfway through because they don't really care what happens to Philip.
Yeah, sure. Though,
I would say most adult literature doesn't have any merit that a college English department would be interested in. They're not assigning a story of the experiences of Abraham Lincoln, a fiction, in these different departments, or Malcolm Gladwell.
They're not assigning a whole lot of Tom Clancy, not a whole lot of John Grisham.
Exactly.
I guess. So it's something thematic, right? It has to do with what, coming of age themes or something like that.
Bill Dunk's romance.
This is what makes it young adult literature?
Reading, a combination of reading level, thematic elements, and just general marketability, I would say would identify young adult literature. And a certain amount of genre bias, right?
And not really having any, thematic material being what the thematic concerns are and also what they aren't, because there is just no shortage of sexy, sexy chastity in the Twilight novels. I think they hold hands, and it's a plot point that they can't really get it on, They can't even really kiss.
That's not really a feature of young adult literature. That was a notable feature of Twilight specifically.
For sure.
By the way, my girlfriend, who has read all of the books, informs me that they do get it on plentifully at the end of the series.
Hey, wait to spoil it.
Spoiler alert.
Spoilers.
Well, they get married.
They get married first?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's all post-nuptial, coitus.
The Traveling Pants girls had the sexy sex, and they are for the young adult set.
Well, it's true. Well, and true. The Gossip Girls have had the dirty, dirty sex, and they are also, nominally anyway, for the young...
And we all know that Frodo and Samwise were getting it on.
Well, so. it's a proud tradition going back to Achilles and Patroclus, right? In the tent.
Right.
So Jordan's read half of one of the books. I've read them all. I read them each in an afternoon. I heard the phrase "new Harry Potter" And I thought, hey, I wonder what that's about. Actually, Harry Potter is a thing. I mean, it is, Harry Potter is, you know, literature for children, but it's also the number of adults who got into it was non-negligible. Though I don't think they went out to the movies in the same way.
If by non-negligible, you mean the greatest for any book ever, all time, other than like the Bible or something.
Yeah. I meant as a proportion of the readership.
Oh, and not as a proportion of adults who are actually reading books, but a proportion of the people who are reading Harry Potter.
Exactly.
Okay, understood.
Yeah, no, in absolute numbers, yeah, I think Harry Potter probably is second only to the Bible.
An interesting thing about the sort of adult audience for Twilight is that because of its status, I think, because of its status as a book in which they're going to wait until they're married to have sex, it became very popular for a certain class of parents to buy the book for their kids, huh, and then to sort of read it with them so they'd have something to talk to them about. And then there's actually a whole separate fan community of, like, Twilight moms. Who want to, they don't really want to talk to their kids about it anymore. They want to talk to other adult women who have also read Twilight and kind of are crushing on Edward Cullen.
Well, here's the thing. I think that there's almost, there's no there in the books. And I don't mean that in a snotty way. I don't mean that as a dig on the books. I mean that they are kind of generic to such an extent that you really can, even more than is standard for this kind of book, you really can project whatever the hell kind of personal narrative you want to onto the books. And I think people get very, very attached to them for that reason, as though the book were all about them. And the book is all about them, because the book is about nothing and they've managed to kind of put themselves into it.
Well, a certain argument would say that that's true of all literature and indeed all language.
Probably. You know, probably. I'll bet it's not an either-or. I mean, I'll bet there's a continuum, you know?
Yeah, and this is right up on one end.
Yeah, I think it is up on one end. Like, the number of clichés. Harold Bloom once said that he counted the number of clichés on a page of Harry Potter, and it was like 40 or something like this. He said, clichés of the dark and stormy night variety.
So specifically clichés about weather and the beginning of the thing?
No, I think
it was raining cats and dogs. There were hailstones as big as golf balls. There were big, dark thunderclouds that were rolling in from the coast.
Yeah, that was a really bad chapter of Harry Potter.
The catalog of the meteorological events. Book 2 of Harry Potter.
So,
quickly, for those listeners who are not aware of Harold Bloom or who he is, he's a Yale professor of killjoyism, I think, is what his specialty
First
is.
First of all, he's emeritus.
Emeritus.
Second of all, it's not killjoyism, it's English literature. but there's killjoyism in other languages, and Harold Bloom does not cover killjoyism in other languages,
though
except
his
for
first,
Cervantes.
Though he grew up speaking Yiddish in his home.
Right.
Really?
Yeah. Yiddish, first language, Sir John Bloomstaff. But don't you think Harold Bloom is enough of a crossover author not to need an explanation?
No, we can throw him out there, especially if we can explain, like, you know, what Twilight is.
Well, I wonder what Harold Bloom would think of Twilight.
I wonder what Harold Bloom would be like if he were a vampire.
Like yeah, he would not be into it. Okay, so, you know, so let's, I mean, we can leave
say,
the, we can leave, oh yeah?
Yeah, I want to say that what would Harold Bloom be like if he were a vampire? It'd be way sexier.
and quite rather skinnier as well. It's funny because he's fat. Well,
yes.
We can leave, I mean, we can come back to Twilight, because I think it is fascinating why people respond to these things, why people respond to what they respond to, and what it is about this particular series that's made it, you know, such a bestseller, and then such a successful...
I want to talk about that for a minute.
Okay, sure. Let's do that now.
Yeah, it's like we were talking about before. Yeah, sorry to hijack the podcast away from you.
God damn it! No, we're going on to overthink other things.
So earlier we were talking about the idea of exploitation in entertainment.
Yeah.
And that's a word that gets thrown around in a lot of different ways. Its original sense, though, had nothing to do with exploitation of the artist.
Right.
Rather, exploitation of the audience. When you say that something like, say, Shaft or Black Caesar, those are blaxploitation movies, or Action Jackson, it's not Carl Weathers who's being exploited. It's
He's awesome.
Yeah, he's awesome. And so are the sort of the black populace, but they're the ones who are being exploited. It's the studio sits down and says, there are all these black people who are not going to movies. I bet if we gave them, like, any movie, no matter how generic, that had a black star, they would all go see it. And that's what, you know, that's what blaxploitation means. And you also get youthsploitation movies where
right.
you have, just young people and all the young people will go see it. And then it starts to get a little bit more vague. When you get something that says sexploitation, it's more that people are going to see it because there's sex in it. So it does get thrown around in a lot of different ways. I think that Twilight might be a very kind of classic exploitation book, exploitation movie, and it's kind of teen girl exploitation.
Sure.
Right.
So I think that that might have a lot to do with its overwhelming success, is that, like you were saying, rather, it's highly generic. Anyone can just sort of read themselves into the story. And it's got a teen girl heroine who, you know, has a brooding Darcy-esque older wealthy man to get attracted to.
Almost sort of Heathcliff-esque, even. Like.
Heathcliff-esque. Yeah, that might be better.
You know,
the cat, right? The Garfield knockoff.
Yeah, exactly.
Every woman wants to be with Heathcliff or Riff Raff.
Vampire, no one should terrorize the neighborhood.
Yeah. I like that. So, I had totally forgotten that there was a Heathcliff cartoon show, like, on TV.
Yeah, with that as the theme song.
And with Mongo in it.
Oh, Mongo was
on the riffraff side.
Yeah, no, Mongo was
giant,
great.
Like, Faulknerian man-child junkyard cat.
So,
hilarious.
Jordan, what happened? Like, did people, was it just a fortunate coincidence that the mental age of the American public seems to be about that of a 14-year-old girl?
Certainly the mental age of 14-year-old girls seems to be about that of a 14-year-old girl.
Yeah, but it's not just kids, and it's not just, I guess it is largely women, 75% women at the movie, but, it's not just girls, it's Twilight moms. They're Twilight moms.
Yeah.
They're like hockey moms.
Romance, right?
They're like hockey moms, but...
A well-marketed romance? Like, a well-marketed romance that falls outside of, like, standard romantic comedic fare?
Saying that it's the next Harry Potter, that it's going to be, you know, of the same quality and cultural significance as Harry Potter is probably wrong. But I think that Harry Potter kind of allowed adult Americans and adult English speakers around the world to read children's books and not be embarrassed about it.
Sure.
So I think that might have a lot to do with the reason that, you know, all these... It's not that, you know, if you went 20 years ago... Middle-aged women wouldn't have been interested in reading about a sexy young vampire who happens to be fantastically wealthy. It's just that now they can do it without, you know, having to blush on the train and put a brown paper cover over the book.
Yeah,
Seventeen years ago, it was all like Interview with a Vampire, right? And you had Brad Pitt, who was the rich, sexy young vampire.
But
right?
those were definitely not.
And Tom Cruise was the teenage girl, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Those movies were not. I mean, the Neil Jordan film of the Anne Rice book, neither of those were meant for kids, right? It was an R-rated movie.
Well, right, but it went for women to an extent, right? It appealed in that sexual way. It had the male leads who are the sex symbols of their day. It provides a genre within which you can acceptably express a sublimated sexual desire for an attractive dude if you're a woman. So, like, in that sense, I'm not seeing a movie just to look at a guy that I think is attractive. I'm going to see this vampire movie, you know, like, or whatever. I don't know. It's a framework that allows for that particular element, and maybe that's in addition to the other parts of the phenomenology.
Well, fair point.
I don't know.
What, so, you know, about vampire movies, we were talking this morning, Josh and I, and Belinky, who is not on the call, but we were talking this morning, and the point was made that it seems, with vampire movies, it seems that the important thing is which of the rules of vampire movies you ignore.
That defines what the movie is?
Well, that defines, that defines the world. That there are these canonical rules about vampires, right? That you can't... Oh, Josh, what were they? I mean, we figured them out this morning.
There's sunlight, there's right. religious artifacts, there's garlic, then there's, like, some of the more obscure ones are, like, you have to be buried in the soil from your homeland. That one gets pretty much ignored by everyone because it makes it very difficult to tell stories.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Stake through
the
heart.
Some vampire stays at home for 500 years.
Stake through the heart, silver bullet, right?
My fiance elbows me in the chest and says that's true in the True Blood thing on HBO these days, that they have to be buried in soil from their homeland.
Huh. But they can, in True Blood, they can go out in the sun, can't they?
No.
Oh, okay. Good.
Would you
like to be introduced, or do you want to just pipe in occasionally?
We have a real Twilight fan here, and we need to make sure she gets introduced first.
She wants me to pretend that was me talking in a high voice.
Okay. Well, then you have to continue talking in a high voice for the rest of the show, okay?
Are we in the midst of some sort of vampire renaissance now, where we have Twilight and, I guess, True Blood is this new HBO TV show about vampires?
That was just a coincidence, right?
Yeah, that was a coincidence. Well, those are based on a slightly less popular series of books, right? The Sookie Smith books or something along those lines?
Stackhouse,
yeah.
Thank you.
She's built like a brick
Thank
stack.
You.
Yes. Somebody summarize just quickly, like, the premise of the True Blood series.
It's the vampire. Someone has developed a source of blood that comes in bottles. It's like synthetic, but it has allowed vampires to live without actually feasting on humans, so that they have revealed themselves and kind of done away with the veil of secrecy about their existence, and now they live among us. In this particular case, in a rat hole in Louisiana,
is that TV show? This is my question: is that TV show horror? Does it have horror elements, or is it just play as a straight up drama?
It has dead people in it.
but my point here is that I feel like vampires are decidedly moved away from being the property of horror movies and horror books and that kind of thing, and they're now the property of. Young adult-oriented romance novels and HBO TV dramas, like Sopranos-esque HBO TV dramas. Is this a fair thing to say?
Well, this is sort of the post-Buffy Blade transformation, right? When you
right, well, Blade was definitely a horror movie. That was it was an action
Blade's
movie.
Blade's an action movie, dude. Blade's not a horror movie.
Blade took vampires to the action movie direction, and Buffy took it to the just general teen drama-ish direction.
Well, I mean, I think the main point is that the vampires in Blade and the vampires in Buffy do not have an overwhelming advantage over the protagonists, which is really what old-timey vampires are largely about, is they have just this massive presence and these massive advantages, and there's this forebodence, and there's this sense of this vast, like, forbidden secret power or what have you that is so much bigger than the sort of individual frail conscience of the protagonist. But when you have a situation where, like, a vampire shows up and you can jump kick them across the room, like, that changes the dynamic. And I think now if you have a situation where they can drink it out of a bottle or they're abstinent and, like, they're just, like, hanging out and, like, playing Parcheesi, like, I think that's a fundamentally different kind of storytelling.
Well, that's the thing.
In a different way.
That's the thing about Twilight is they are abstinent. The good vampires, anyway, abstain from human blood, but they are totally overpowering, right? There is just no competition for the humans. It's not like there could be a Buffy who could kick some vampire ass. Actually, you know what? Bella Swan, the main character in Twilight versus Buffy, is an interesting comparison and kind of gets to the heart of, like, what's different about those two works. You know, Joss Whedon knows how to show you a good time, but he also makes you work for it a little bit, you know, whereas these other books are really total wish fulfillment, you know, and total sort of sweep you off your feet. And so there's no, like, I don't think there's really a social message to the, I don't think there's a social message to the Twilight books the way there is to Buffy, where the vampires, where it's very clear what the vampires stand for, at least at first. I guess it gets more complicated as it goes on.
It's interesting that...
No, you go ahead, Jordan, go ahead.
That in the one that you're characterizing as total wish fulfillment, Twilight, Bella is, at least in the first book, I don't know if this changes, she's notably powerless, whereas Buffy, you know, is super strong and super fast and would seem to be much more of a wish fulfillment character. I think this might be why some people sort of jump ugly with Twilight and say that it's a anti-feminist work, is that it is wish fulfillment, and part of her wish is that her significant other be much, much stronger than she is, and right, able to, you know. Well,
didn't she just get that by dating someone on the football team? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know why they're vampires if they don't drink people's blood. I don't understand. Are they just like shitty superheroes? Like, what's the deal?
Well, they've foregone it. It's a sign of their abstinence from blood is like their abstinence from sex before marriage. It's just a sign of self-denial and character.
But if you have a werewolf that abstains from turning into a werewolf, you know what I call that? I call that a dude. He's not a werewolf anymore. He doesn't look at the full moon and howl and turn into a werewolf and run around and bite things. Then he is dude, even if he has, you know, Jason Bateman or Michael J. Fox as a distant relative.
There's a there is a question about the werewolves in Twilight. The werewolf situation in Twilight is complicated.
There are werewolves and vampires in this movie, and Kate Beckinsale is not in it.
Well, she does.
they haven't made the second one yet, so, you know, I'm sure they're in talks with her agent.
Yeah, right, exactly. Kate Beckinsale will show up later on. No, right, yeah. The ontology of the so-called werewolves is something that is revealed actually in the very last moments of the final book to be somewhat more complicated. But they show up in the second book and you think they're just regular old werewolves. Wish fulfillment. I mean a much sort of more base wish fulfillment, right? That is to say, it's about a wish really to be a child rather than a wish to be an ass-kicking grown-up. We want to be taken care of, I think, everyone on some level, and sort of these books, I guess, dramatize that and sort of indulge it in a way. Now, I mean, by the end of number four, she is an ass-kicking sort of woman, but she has to brood and sort of look longingly and with sexy, sexy chastity at the vampire dude before she can do it.
And then she trains in like 100 times Earth's gravity and learns how to punch vampires and jump kick them. Is that what happens?
She just gets bit on the neck.
I'll let you find out. Yeah, no spoiler alert.
Yeah,
you know. You better wear a weighted vest, or I'm not reading it.
Spoiler alert: she does not turn out to be from Dragon Ball.
God damn it! That movie's gonna come out after all its production delays, and it's gonna be involved just as many wire stunts as Twilight, although probably less plot.
So someone posted to the Overthinking at Twitter account. Wow, Josh had sirens and I have sirens tonight. It's like, it's a high crime night. They're out chasing vampires, I guess. Someone posted to the OTI Twitter account that it seems that in zombie movies, no one really knows what zombies are. But in vampire movies, everyone knows what vampires are. So there are ghost ship moments in both.
Clarify what a ghost ship moment is for our audience?
Do I need to have? Is it something that we've discussed before? I'll say it before. A ghost ship moment is the moment at which the characters in the movie discover what the audience already knows because they've heard the title.
Right.
Specifically, in the movie Ghost Ship, it's when everyone gets onto the boat and suddenly they realize, oh wait, the boat is haunted.
There are ghosts on this ship. Yeah. Right?
It's like, and so noises, and they don't know, and then it's like, holy shit, it's a ghost ship.
And it's, I think it's a mark of quality of a certain kind of movie when the ghost ship moment happens as quickly as possible, so yeah. so you can get on with the awesomeness of having ghosts on the ship, and not like worry about, hey, what's this on the ship that's, you know, making things go all funny.
Yeah.
Anyway,
is there a ghost ship moment in Twilight? Is there like did Twilight have a good ghost ship moment?
Yeah.
Sort of. Yeah. I mean, where she realizes that dude's a vampire.
Right. Right.
Because it's not clear. The point about the vampires is that they can pass.
Right, but this moment, it's a little bit different than what we're talking about with this, what the Twitter original post is talking about. Now, when this character discovers that this dude is a vampire, she knows what vampires are, right? She knows that, oh my God, you drink blood and all this stuff.
Yeah, but it's, you know what, it's this weird, it's sort of weird because it's like, oh, those are just stories, you know?
So it occurs that she's heard in the world of the movie and the book.
In the world of the book, she's heard stories. You know, she's read Dracula or whatever.
Yeah.
There's actually a scene where she goes onto the internet and like Googles vampires to do some research, and then like her sort of big moment of what's the term in Greek tragedy when like you realize everything? Is that recognitio or is that peripeteia?
Is the changing, so it's the recognition moment that you're
okay, yeah,
about.
The recognition is like she reads off a list of characteristics of vampires that he has, you know, so it is very much drawing from, you know.
Wow, that sounds pretty sophisticated.
Crazy, crazy hotness, smoldering looks, sexy, sexy chastity.
Yeah, and it's basically, it's like the...
Cold as ice, hard to the touch, everywhere except where it counts.
Yeah, yeah. For some reason, not willing to bite me and make me a vampire, even though I yearn for it in my heart. The movie, like, the structure of the movie is... by the way, let me tell you, I watched the movie. The structure is a little bit floppy. It has two climaxes. One of them, though, is definitely the big sort of, oh my God, you're a vampire scene. It's like what it's about, almost.
Yeah. Right, and that's... that's the thing, like, because the movie was being, the only trailers you could see really at first were the action trailers, and it seemed like it was going to be about James tracking Bella and Edward, you know? And that seemed kind of silly to me, because it's this kind of brooding romance that happens to have, you know, 75 pages of action kind of tacked on at the end.
Much like the Harry Potter movies, where, like, there's not a plot until the last 10 pages of the book.
And I'd say that, I'd say, though, that the Harry Potter movies, like, their achievement is in the realization of that world, you know, which is so, which is very deftly drawn in that you can really imagine it.
Right. So getting back to the piece, you're saying that the Twitter comment, you're saying that when the ghost ship moment happens in a vampire movie, the characters draw upon pre-existing knowledge of what these kinds of things are and how they work.
Exactly.
Right?
Whereas,
like, oh,
whereas,
I know what a vampire is. Oh, okay, we're dealing with vampires.
And it's more like you belong to this category that I have a priori knowledge of, you know, that you fit into this category, though I thought that kind of thing wasn't possible. And in zombie movies, it's more like, wow, these corpses are being reanimated and coming after us, you know, to eat our flesh.
Yeah, yeah. And although there are certainly exceptions, which are mostly metatextual, like Shaun of the Dead, a lot of the time, yeah, they learn as they go what the zombies are and how they work, and they don't draw on pre-existing knowledge.
Right, exactly. Like, there isn't a Google site. There isn't, like, a... You know, now, in our world, in our actual non-narrative world, we have lots of information about what zombies are and how they would behave under certain circumstances.
We have a zombie survival guide.
Right, exactly. And,
yeah.
You know, a fine book called World War Z.
Right, so on World War Z, and Fenzel, don't worry, I won't spoil anything for you, Fenzel.
Yeah,
by the way... Readers, definitely read it if you have any interest in zombies at all. But World War Z definitely...
And who does not? If you do not have any interest in zombies, you are listening to the wrong podcast, my friend. You find another website to go and frequent.
There are lots of sexy teenagers in it, too. So if you're listening for Twilight, read World War Z. It's all about people making out, light necking, like above, everything above the shoulders.
Ha 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 ha!
So World War Z is, I think, unique in zombie fiction. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's just, it is such an incredibly in-depth portrayal of and examination of zombie culture and zombie tropes that if there were a zombie work where you would find the characters analyzing what to do with zombies based on prior knowledge of zombies, then that would be it. But it's decidedly not there in that every, they're decidedly, this is a new phenomenon, completely unknown, and they don't know what to do with these zombies. And they have to figure out this whole thing about you have to shoot them in the head. You have to take out the head.
We're always discovering zombies for the first time.
Right, exactly.
That's kind of the classic thing that people have to figure out about zombies, right? Is like shooting them in the head. That's always new every time.
Now, there are a couple of exceptions in the zombie canon. Like, one is Dawn of the Dead or Day of the Dead, which is the one that happens in the shopping mall.
That's Dawn of the Dead, but that's also a sequel, right?
Right, exactly. So yeah. Sequel to Night of the Living Dead. And then... isn't there one where it's like there's a virus or something and
weeks later?
Well, there's a lot of them where there are viruses, like Resident Evil.
Sequel to 28 Days Later, which was 28 weeks later, I believe.
Sequels are mostly the exception, I think.
Yeah, they'd have to be.
In 28 Days Later, they're not classic zombies. You can kill them any old way. They're just people who are infected with the virus. So, but there again, it's not like people, when this starts happening, people say, oh, well, they're zombies. So clearly what we should be doing is shooting them in the head. All the zombie movies take place in worlds where there are no zombie movies, except for Shaun of the Dead, like we were saying, which is, metatextual.
I think one of the attractions of zombies is their resistance to being psychologized. In the way that you can psychologize a vampire, either in the kind of, Byronic hero way that it gets done in Twilight, or in the, allegory of teen sexuality way that it gets done in Buffy.
I was thinking a lot about this morning, and I was thinking about how zombies are great for modern sensibility because they're a probabilistic systemic risk. Like, they're the causes that would make a zombie outbreak a really big problem are already existent, but they haven't necessarily caused the zombie outbreak to happen because you haven't had that actual zombie appear. And everybody sort of knows that if a zombie were to appear, we're all really screwed because none of us have really useful skills in an apocalypse situation. We all live in really close quarters and we can't trust each other. So, but it's a probabilistic event. Like, at some point, something's going to go wrong and everything's going to fall apart, right? And all the situation for it is pre-existing. But the cause itself is sort of, like, the actual zombie is just sort of the seed that creates the problem in a system where the causes already exist. Whereas with the vampires, and I was also thinking about werewolves, are heavily individually causal. Like, if the circumstance exists for a vampire to be created, then a vampire is created, and then the vampire becomes, like, a major figure in the story, and the things that they do are tied to the reasons why it all happened.
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of vampire movies where, a vampire shows up in town, and the town has all these, unrelated characteristics that have nothing to do with why the vampire's there, that then causes the vampire to flourish in a way that it might not flourish elsewhere. Like, oftentimes, the characteristics of a town are linked to the characteristics of a vampire. And I think this is also linked to the fact that an issue of mutability, right, which is that, to become a vampire is just to an extent become unchanging. And zombie apocalypse, all zombie stories are really zombie apocalypse stories, are about, change and about scary systemic change and the kind of change that could destroy the world and run out of control, which has become so common in the post-Hiroshima global environment. I've been practicing that all day, so that's my spiel.
Wow.
Pete, I'm not sure I understood you, but there's one movie that kind of ties a lot of these themes together, and that's 30 Days of Night. Have you guys seen that?
No, but I heard it was good.
It is good, and what it is, I won't be giving too much away here that you wouldn't get in the first 8 minutes, but essentially it's a town in Alaska where the sun never rises for 30 days because it's so far north, and the vampires figure this out, and we're like, well, we're going to go up there and have a 30-day party.
Right.
But they're not kind of the traditional vampires. They're much more like the zombies that we're talking about. They're non-sexual. They don't really have much in the way of personality. They're kind of just, and they show up. You don't know anything. The townspeople know nothing about them, and they just start kind of destroying systematically this town. in a very apocalyptic sort of way.
So, Josh, my question is, are they characters in the same sense that, you know, Dracula can be a character, or are they just, like, completely just faceless beasts that, you know, go,
there's one who's kind of clearly a leader, but I'd say in sum, they have perhaps 10 lines of dialogue in the whole movie.
So I wonder if, could you maybe argue that that's in fact a zombie movie?
You actually could. They do drink blood as opposed to, you know, eating brains, and they are concerned about it being nighttime as opposed to daytime. So in that way, they're clearly vampires. But aside from that, it is almost kind of exactly what we're describing as a zombie movie. You guys should check it out. It's really well done.
I think another interesting one would be I Am Legend, right? Which I think started out as a vampire story, and then when they made it into a movie, I think because it fits the zombie narrative so much better, because it's a huge extenuating circumstance that creates everything that happens, they become much more like zombies, right? They become sort of like these like disfigured human beings. They're less associated with like Count Dracula than they were in like the original
book. Right. But in at least the I Am Legend movie, the creatures, for lack of a better word, they don't go out during the day.
Right.
That's like a biological thing as a result of their illness. But in terms of the characterization or the humanization of them, they're kind of in that gray area there as well in terms of the spectrum. They are more advanced and more articulate, for lack of a better word,
than the standard
zombie. But they're, you know, their vocabulary is definitely quite limited.
Another interesting movie for this, I think it's called Death Dream, although it has like a couple of different titles because it's, you know, very kind of fly-by-nighty thing. Directed by the guy, I think, who did the makeup effects from Night of the Living Dead. Anyway, it's about a guy who comes back from Vietnam as a zombie. And in some ways, like, he looks like a zombie. A lot of the things that he does are zombie-ish. But in some ways, it's very much more like a vampire movie because he is intelligent. He does talk. He does kind of, like, seduce people. And although, I mean, like, he's, you know, he doesn't have fangs, he doesn't drink blood in any sense, but he acts more like a vampire, even though he looks like a zombie.
Interesting. It's like an easy spirit. Looks like a pump, but it feels like a sneaker.
Yes. Pretty much just exactly like that.
Excellent. No, I think that's cool. I think it's interesting that we can sort of identify a kind of or-vampire narrative and an or-zombie narrative, and that even when you take the characters and juxtapose them into the other kind of story, you do get the sense as you watch it that there's something zombie-ish about this, or there's something vampire-ish about this.
Yeah.
And it is weird that zombies and vampires and werewolves like all convert by biting. That is kind of strange that those three monsters all operate in the same way, and that there's this act of transformation that sort of loss of control through the dark world. But it happens in very distinct ways and tends to lend itself to very distinct stories, and only one of them involves basketball.
Which one?
That would be Teen Wolf.
I was about to say, yeah, I knew what it was right, as the word witch left my mouth. So here's a question. So, I think we have several examples in which vampires and werewolves appear in the same narratives, but typically zombies just are on their own.
Zombies are presented. This is another thing about zombies is that they are sort of post-superstitious in a way, and that the explanation for zombies is very often scientific. It's a virus or it's some kind of contagion, you know, that's passed as a disease is passed, and it's understood as a natural process that, you know, is subject to the laws of science, as opposed to an expression of capital E evil in some way.
Right. Now, of course, this is because the voodoo association has been stripped out of the zombie over the years.
Well, we were talking about voodoo zombies, and we were talking about, like, golem, like, yeah. Yiddish zombies. Whoever's typing, stop that now. We were talking about Yiddish zombies, and they can't, okay, resume typing very quietly.
Is Harold Bloom a Yiddish zombie? Is that what you're saying?
No, they were not. They weren't dead. They were made out of mud, right?
Right.
Scroll in Harold Bloom's head that says deconstruct.
B They are controlled by, you know, commands from their master creator.
Right. They're like robots.
Right, yeah, they're muddy robots. And so that they're different from just like undifferentiated hordes of the undead, you know, screaming for brains.
Right.
So that I think that Frankenstein, right, was a Frankenstein is a zombie solution to a golem problem.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that is like, yeah. he's sort of he is sort of, you know, his master wants him to be one way, wants him to be the old kind of voodoo zombie, but he's the new technological zombie. He's also,
well, you're talking more about the movie Frankenstein, because the book Frankenstein, like, he wants him to be like really brilliant, right? He doesn't want him to be like shambling or stupid, right? He wants him to be a pinnacle of, or a paragon of human achievement or quality, right?
Right, in kind of every way, in intellectually, yeah, and physically, and in strength, feats of strength, and so forth.
Like an American Gladiator.
Right, exactly. If American Gladiator had like a talent competition and a quiz that went along with it.
It is kind of cool when all those monsters all coexist and you get to see the differences between them. Like, they didn't say, like, Van Helsing, with the exception of zombies. But, you know, sometimes it doesn't go so well, like in Van Helsing.
Van Helsing, though, was not concerned with any... Like, the great thing about these characters is that you start from basic premises and then you can kind of build out a world that is internally consistent. Whereas with Van Helsing, it was more like a remix. It was more like, you know, Gothic Horror, the remix album.
Right. Well, it was a tribute to a lot of the old Lon Chaney kind of stuff, at least the beginning of it was. And then it kind of like stepped out from there in sort of a similar level of silliness, but it was ramped up by contemporary sensibilities and also James Bond ripoffs and other nonsense.
Yeah,
so, and lots of cleavage. A lot of cleavage in that movie. A lot of cleavage.
Was there bullet time in Van Helsing?
I think it was crossbow time.
Now that had Kate Beckinsale in it.
Yeah, Kate Beckinsale made three movies in a very short period of time that involved vampires and werewolves fighting each other. And they were Underworld, Underworld Evolution, and Van Helsing, right?
Followed by Underworld 3, Rise of the Lycans, right?
Oh, is that out?
That's coming.
Are you making that up as in Rise of the Machine?
No, that actually does exist. It's really...
So they're copying the name from Terminator, pretty much.
Yes.
Like, so it's like Rise of the Werewolves, except they're calling them Lycans because that's the name in the movie. Fair enough. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, that's a place where these monsters coexist, and like that was the way that they tried to package them, and it was a sort of post very Blade influenced, very Matrix influenced, very stylized movie about the characters from them.
Probably more than anything else, very Vampire the Masquerade influenced, right?
Yeah, I was wondering when we were going to get to that. Is anyone else on this call ever played Vampire the Masquerade?
No, I was more into Mage the Ascension.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I played, my favorite of the White Wolves was Werewolf the Apocalypse.
Uh-huh.
But you know, did anybody else ever play any of those games?
No.
Okay, so for the uninitiated, basically...
I came dangerously close to LARPing on one occasion.
Well, you know, I mean, there might be some people out there who really like that stuff who are listening, and we definitely approve, but it's definitely a little bit scary for the uninitiated, I'll say that much.
For sure.
But, like, a little quick background, these are tabletop role-playing games, like Dungeons & Dragons, except the rules are a lot simpler, and they are meant more for, like, a kind of more theatrical sort of role-playing. And there were a series of different systems you could play that were all modular and could all work together to a lesser or greater extent. And I think that they were werewolves, vampires, mages. I think there were wraiths at one point. But they took place in kind of a sort of, this was back in like the mid-90s, like early to mid-90s, and then through the rest of the 90s, they were a kind of a blip. You might remember people talking about kids getting killed in like the sewers of Toronto because they managed to get down there and they were doing masquerade, LARPing, and they bit each other and it was sad. But this is all tied to the whole like Satanism in tabletop role playing gaming and customizable card gaming that happened in like the mid 90s.
Well, this was this was like, and as far back as like even before we were kids with D&D, it was very.
Yeah.
You know, accusations of Satanism were huge. I remember my mother actually saying, "You know, kids who play Dungeons and Dragons—that's satanic."
Yeah, which is kind of crazy when you think about it.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you know, whatever. But yeah, but the main thing is this was very associated with the whole Anne Rice milieu. They sort of like it was like sexy, you know, like dark, mysterious places and intrigue. There's even a short-lived television show. And I remember, and I believe in the in Twilight, and correct me if I'm wrong, are there not like two primary like sort of factions of vampires that have different characteristics that are in sort of an extended conflict with each other?
Well, they're not really conflict, but there are those who have kind of opted out of the eating people kind of thing.
Right. Do they have like a name that they have collectively and like a culture?
They call themselves vegetarians.
Oh, okay.
There's not enough of them. There's not like an organized group. It's just like a family unit.
And this is a characteristic of the vampires in Twilight, which is that they are non-social.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they tend to fight when they get together, so they mainly keep to themselves or in like long-term mating pairs. Not mating because they don't procreate, but you know, long-term sexy vampire sex pairs.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
So without a social element, and they don't drink blood, I guess Dracula was kind of solitary, but he wasn't a schmoozer, and he was charismatic.
He also, but he had a bevy of, you know, Dracula had that bevy of, you know, hot, scantily clad, barely legal vampires gone wild. Around.
I believe Elliot Spitzer slept with one of them.
Hey, speaking of Britney Spears documentary, she was on TV this weekend, wasn't she?
What are you talking about?
Alicia Dupre?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right. She made some sort of meaningless apology to Elliot Spitzer's wife.
Yeah,
by the way, I haven't been in the news in a while. I'm sorry that I slept with your husband.
She went... this is totally a rat hole and completely off topic, but I feel like that's not her fault. Like, if you are a sex worker, you know, if your business is exchanging having sex with people for money, I think that you're not necessarily a homewrecker in the same way that you would be if you were sleeping in the same with the same person not for money.
Right. It's like if you go around, like, beating the shit out of people... You shouldn't really be responsible for damaging his shoes. It's like the greater thing that you're doing that's socially disruptive kind of absolves you of a certain amount of responsibility for being accused of lesser crime. Being like, that guy got my way, got my personal space. I mean, he also mugged me, but like he totally made me feel uncomfortable on the tee. You know,
or just that sex workers don't, you know, pick and choose who they sleep with in the same way that people who have sex without it being for money do. That, like, if a guy comes to you and says, here's the money, do the job, you're not going to be like, are you married? I don't know how I feel about this.
So should the Twilight Lady make a book about a prostitute who every time that she's approached for sex considers the morality of it and decides not to do it, but instead hangs out with a person for no money?
See, I want to respond to your criticism of the book saying that they're not vampires if they don't drink human blood. I think that that's a... That's a very Old Testament idea of what vampires are, but that if you read your scripture, you'll know that if you have lusted after the blood of a human in your heart, then you are a vampire.
I have come not to abolish the vampires, but to uphold them.
Wait, that's Shakespeare. That's not scripture.
No, that's Jesus, right?
Oh, I
come not
okay.
To I
guess.
The law, but the other. Anyway.
But to fulfill, I was thinking, I've come not to bury Caesar, but to praise him.
So Jordan, when is Maccabees? Like, when is the transition between the Old Testament and the New Testament in vampirism? Like, where is it? Where can I find, like, the difference between old-timey and new-timey vampires, other than in this one series?
That was a very inside baseball scripture reference, Pete. I just want to congratulate you on that one, because I thought it was awesome.
Oh, well, thank you.
I'm not saying that the distinction in here is in the text. I'm saying that it's in your personal, like, classification system of what vampires are.
And so I'm being like a fire and brimstone vampire analyzer who's not really considering more nuanced ideas about vampirism.
I'm not saying that you're fire and brimstone and unnuanced. I'm just saying that you're Old Testament, that you're essentially legalistic, and you say that if they don't drink blood, if they don't commit the act, then they are innocent, which is, you know, it's the way all of our law systems work. But I'm saying that the Twilight vampires, although they don't drink human blood, every time they see a person, they think, oh, man, love to drink the blood right now. You can also think about it that, you know, someone who's a recovering alcoholic, they never stop being an alcoholic just because they haven't drunk, you know, for 20 years. They're still alcoholics who are dry. These are dry vampires.
Does she succeed in the books, and do they succeed in the movie in sort of keeping up that subtext continuously? Or, I mean, I haven't seen the movie or read the books. I would fear that it would be lost, and you would end up with a character who is kind of just a vampire in name and not a vampire in, like, actual narrative function.
No, it's totally kept up because, like, it's part of this kind of sexy chastity thing where he really wants to drink her blood all the time, but he refrains.
That sounds like it would get really boring after a while.
Yeah, but you know what? OMG, Twilight.
You know, there's another prominent, recovered vampire, or vampire who doesn't drink humans' blood, that we're forgetting here, and that is the Count in Sesame Street. Definitely not drinking any blood on that show.
That's what he's counting, is one day since I killed a human and drunk her blood. 2 days.
But he's kept the other elements of the vampire canon, which include the widow's peak, the goatee, like the castle full of bats, like all the stuff that gets thrown out of contemporary vampires, like from the get-go, he held on to really hardcore. You got to respect that.
I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry for Count, the Count, whose last name is Von Count, so it's Count Von Count.
Put that link on the podcast, Matt. We need to have our readers listen to this.
Absolutely. So he doesn't sleep during the day. He sleeps at night. He doesn't sleep in a coffin. He's out in the sunlight, though. This is an important aspect here. He's, you know, it's not vampire-ish. But yeah, certainly all the other tropes, the accent, the maniacal laughter, the bats and whatnot. Yeah, that's all vampire-ish.
There's a whole.
I
mean,
be a vampire.
We didn't get into it, and we probably can't because we sort of have to wrap up because we've been going for more than an hour. But there's a whole. I mean, there's a whole history to these things, to like the classic vampire stuff that goes back to Dracula and Vlad the Impaler and, you know, Transylvania, such as it is. And to the evil, you know, and to the evil European continent versus the righteous, you know, and morally upstanding British island kingdom of Great Britain, and so on. But we might have to leave that for another time. Anyone have a parting shot on zombies or vampires or Twilight?
I think werewolves are awesome and underutilized in movies. I said it. They are often underutilized.
Hey, are we going to do a what we're excited about?
Do you have something that you're excited about?
That one that Pete just brought up. So if everyone else wants to do it, we should. But if it's just going to be me, you know,
no,
I can
skip
it.
We can do picks.
Yeah, sure. We'll do picks. Let's do some picks. Okay, Overthink This. The it's been on hiatus, but now it's back. Jordan, go for it.
All right, so Pete's saying werewolves are an underutilized resource. I was thinking to myself, when was the last time I saw a werewolf movie that didn't have vampires and Kate Beckinsale in it? And the movie that comes up is it's called Ginger Snaps. It is Canadian. It's about werewolfism as a metaphor for a girl sort of going through the onset of menstruation. And it is a fabulous, fabulous horror movie. Can't recommend it enough.
These things are always, aren't they always about, aren't they always about, you know, the onset of adolescence in a way? Not Dracula. I guess Dracula wasn't. Never mind. I don't know what I'm talking about. Say the title of the movie again, Jordan.
Ginger Snaps.
Ginger Snaps. All right, that is Jordan. And so that the other guys can think of one, I will make my pick, which is Schott's Miscellany. It was a book that was given to me recently, and it is an almanac. It contains a lot of information about, you know, the statistics about countries, the largest landmass, the deepest river, and, you know, and so on, about people, about sort of social geography, about physical geography, about the political world, about all these things. It's like an almanac or a kind of record book in this sense, but it's written by this guy named Ben Schott, who is very witty and, you know, intersperses little explanatory paragraphs and then puts weird statistics in among the other ones. So Schott's Miscellany, 2009, I actually read it from like 2 to 3 in the morning last night. It kept me from going to bed, though I was quite tired, for an hour, because it was fascinating and exciting. Schott's Miscellany.
Sounds kind of like the areas of my expertise, the true version.
It is. It actually is kind of like that. And it's not, you know, it's not as funny, obviously, because it's, you know, lots of depressing things like, you know, rates of child poverty or something like that. But, you know, but he, like, most miserable cities in America, for example, like taking the misery index, which I guess has to do with cost of living and inflation, or unemployment and inflation, and, you know, combining those rankings with rankings for cost of living for a place. So, like, for example, the most miserable city in America is Detroit.
That was going to be my guess. Bad but true.
Based on unemployment versus inflation and cost of living, that is the most miserable city in the world to live in, apparently, at the moment. But, you know, so, and it's all kind of done in an irreverent way. I really, yeah, it's like, it's the areas of my expertise, but all with, you know, with extensive reference to, you know, census data.
Cool.
Anyway, Peter Mark?
Yeah, I got, it's not particularly obscure or overthought, but my pick is to give Chinese democracy a chance. Literally, as in, you know, don't just write it off as like, oh, Axl Rose finally wrote this album and everyone says it's kind of crappy and it's not, doesn't have Slash and Izzy and all the other GNR folks. Put that aside. Put that aside. Just give it a shot. Either go to the record store and, you know, scan the CD in the preview thing, or find the clips online, or I don't know, BitTorrent it like I did. I mean, sorry, you can bleep that out, rather. give it a shot, listen to it, evaluate it as the music that it is. And it's not bad. Give it a shot. You might like it. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Give Chinese democracy a chance is his pick. And
also,
Pete,
yes, give the actual form of government, Chinese democracy, a chance in China. That's my plea to the to Hu Jintao.
Okay, you'll probably be asking me to bleep that when they come for you at night, but you know. So Pete, what do you got?
Well, the obvious one, and the thing that I really want to stress, is that this is probably going to go up on Monday. On Tuesday, which is the day after Monday, series finale of The Shield. It's the most exciting cop drama that isn't The Wire, which I haven't seen. It's been really thrilling season. It's been really exciting. If you've been keeping up, watch it. If you haven't been keeping up, keep up. Like, get up to speed, and when you have an opportunity on DVD, watch it. I'm psyched for this. I know a lot of my friends are psyched for this. And listen to our podcast, which we're going to post special supplement after The Shield finale, to hear our take on how it all wraps up. What happens to all the main characters.
Yeah, and overthinking the whole 7 years of this thing.
Exactly. Now, and I'll make a side claim, because that's kind
mere
of like
hours.
A promo.
By the way, mere hours after you know, the curtain comes down on the series, we will have a podcast up about it. So yes. If you really want to stay up late, if you are so jazzed that you cannot get to sleep and think that the dulcet tones of me, Belinky, and Fenzel will help you, yeah, thanks for that laugh. really geeking out, like geeking out in a very intense way about The Shield. You can download it that very night. Sorry, Pete. You have a side pick.
Well, just my side pick is I'm a big fan of Ninja Warrior, and I hope that, also known as Sasuke in Japan, which is the Japanese obstacle course game show. It's really not like Extreme Elimination Challenge or the ones that have been ported to America in like a really funny way. If you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. But there's been a guy on this show that was the winner of the G4, and G4 is the cable network that in this country shows Ninja Warrior. He won a contest for people sending in their videos, and he's a parkour runner of the last name of Muhlenberg. And he has been doing some sick things on Ninja Warrior. So get yourself on G4 and or get on YouTube or something and watch some of this Muhlenberg guy stuff on Ninja Warrior. Watch him against Nagano and the other Ninja Warrior All-Stars. Because if you, like me, love the show and maybe you drift away from it a little bit, these are some really good guys, and they're really up in the level of competition. And if you've never seen Ninja Warrior, you know, Google it, watch the ridiculousness and really the human achievement and the awesome announcing and people swinging on ropes and climbing on things, and it's really, it's a sincere and beautiful thing.
Awesome.
So, my second pick is Muhlenberg on Ninja Warrior.
Excellent. You can contact us at podcast@overthinkingit.com or by phone on the podcast voicemail line at 20-EAT-LOG-01. That's 203-285-6401. Leave a message there. Say if you want it played on the air and leave your name and where you're calling from, and we can play that on the air for you. And as always, check us out at www.overthinkingit.com, the blog that subjects the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve.